Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Bhutang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. So it feels nice to be moving more and more into our Vasa retreat, into our annual monastic winter retreat. As I was saying at lunchtime, it's an opportunity for all of us here to be able to step back a little bit from our usual daily routines and usual interactions, engagements, even though we still have some of that, just being conscious that this is a time that we try to protect and encourage more seclusion, more solitude, more focus on formal practice. It's something, a time that we enter into very consciously, but as in any period of practice, if it's just a sitting practice or an hour of sitting practice, if we go into it with expectations, we will surely be disappointed, because often our expectations are based on ideals and hopes. Or sometimes fears, sometimes our expectations are fearful. In that case, we wouldn't be disappointed if we didn't meet fearful things. But just to be aware about expectations, about what we're hoping to achieve, what we're hoping to get out of it, what we're hoping to conquer, to get rid of within oneself. Because if this isn't conscious, we do get disappointed when our reality doesn't meet our ideas of what we think it should be. Yeah? So even, for all of us, whether you've been meditating a long time or meditating a short time, we can have these expectations about the path, the practice, what's going to come of it. So it's best to approach practice to recognize any expectations, to not judge, but just to know what's present as an expectation or hope or fear, and then just see what, if you can just gently kind of let it go, come back into the present moment and realize that this is the way it is right now. The future has not yet arrived. The past is a memory. Yesterday is gone. The future has not yet come. And the way it is now is just what we need to be with, to look at, to work with, to rest with. And this is something we kind of have to catch ourselves again and again, because these expectations and hopes and fears, some of them can be very subtle. And in the habituated mind stream, in fact, when you do a lot of sitting or contemplative practice, you start to see that there's almost this inbuilt hope and fear, habituated hope and fear in our way of being. We're always kind of, often kind of doing something for an idea of reward or satisfaction or getting something out of it. And on a rational level, that sounds fine. Why would you do something if you weren't going to get anything out of it? Yeah? But when you look at the mind stream, when you look at the experience of mind, when it is affected by this kind of there's a kind of a subtle projection into an imagined future where we position ourselves and try to set ourselves up in order to achieve an imagined goal. And this positioning is in itself stressful. And this subtle imagining of something to be got, something to be had, something that I haven't quite got, but I might nearly be there, or if I just get my understanding together, or get my samadhi together, or get all the factors of the practice path together, then I might get there. Yeah. And there's this subtle sense of got to do something in order to get something else or something other, something that's not present. And this can be very, very subtle in our minds, and we don't see it often when we're in activity, when we're doing the things that need to be done on a day-to-day basis. We're not often aware of it. When it comes to sitting meditation practice, we have an opportunity to become aware of that. Or we just start to see it. Unless we're fooled by this idea, I've just got to get it all together. Just do this, do that, and I'll get it. It's not quite right now. So this contemplate this way of practice is to actually look at what is that feeling of things are not quite right now, the way it is right now, that things are not quite right, that I have to do something to change something or get somewhere else or get rid of something. It doesn't feel complete. Can't be all right just as it is. You know, that this unease, this dis-ease, this dissatisfaction is dukkha, is the dukkha that the Buddha's pointing to. So it can be so endemic within our way of being, within our way of thinking of who we are, who I am and what I need to become or should be or what I shouldn't be. Just in our way of thinking about myself or my situation. You know, so waking up to this subtle level of dukkha, of dis-ease, of dissatisfaction, a slight agitation or a quality of just not quite able to rest and relax, not fully just present. This kind of quality of dukkha needs to be seen and to be questioned. And when we do that, when we recognize it, discern it for what it is, there's that slight agitation that's present, or slight hope or fear, something about the future, or some concern of the past, or concern for the future, or even concern for now because I don't feel peaceful now. You're just looking at that, seeing that this is an experience of dukkha, bringing that into perspective. And maybe you have to challenge your belief a little bit in that moment, you know, by just saying, where do I think I'm going to get to? Is there aversion in the mind? Is there's some aversion for something that's present? Is the mind, or the body indeed, tensing up against some feeling of unpleasant feeling in the body, or unpleasant mental state or emotional state? How is that? If the body or the mind is feeling tense, can we look directly at it and recognize, yeah, there's this tense feeling in the body? Not to analyze it so much to try to understand it psychologically or rationally, but can we just bring it into full awareness? So whenever I do that, I find whenever I am able to do that, I find something then relaxes. If there's tension in the body, once I make it fully conscious, there's a relaxation. Because I recognize, or something recognizes in that moment, that there's a this holding, this tensing is something that's being done. It's a doing. Yeah, but it's not seen. It's a habitual way of holding. And when it's seen, when it's brought into full consciousness, something relaxes around that. Well, maybe in my own practice, maybe I've challenged it enough to see that, you know, when it does come into full consciousness, I can recognize there's no need for that holding here and now. This is just a habit. And so my body relaxes. And in that relaxing, or the relaxing of a tense mind state, there's an ability to be more present immediately. It's just, and what I mean by more present is just relaxing into this moment. There's no longer a judging of this moment. No longer the desire that's subtly moving, looking for something else. You know, this subtle habitual desire and fear, or hope and fear, it's so habitual, it's kind of just operating there unless we see it, unless we wake up to it, and then there's an opportunity to relax out of it. And then to sustain, allow that more present quality of presence, more full awareness, to be able to rest into that and allow that to deepen. And then we can find a way of being in the present without having to have any reason to be in the present, or any hope that something good is going to come out of this, or any fear that something not good might happen. But just this feeling into this capacity to just rest into this present moment without the habitual desire or aversion, wanting, not wanting, where mental movements and thoughts and concepts start traveling into the future. And this is such a habitual movement of the mind, we have to keep waking up to it, you know. And we won't know, we don't get to taste what it is, what the benefit is about waking up to that, the benefit of waking up to that, unless we do it. So we taste a little bit of peace in that moment. We taste a quality of being, a quality that's somehow inherently in this ability just to be present. Quality of peace in that beingness that we don't taste when we're caught in this stream of moving into the future or hanging on to the past and this agitation of hope and fear or desire and aversion. So that touching into that quality of peace, even if it's momentary, is so helpful. So necessary for this particular path of cultivation, to know that that is there, to know that it's there despite this wandering mind, but this wandering mind doesn't always recognize it. Yeah? But when it wakes up, when it snaps out of this habitual momentum, then this quality of being can be felt, can be known. And this quality of peacefulness, the lack of desire, the lack of the push-pull, even for a moment. And the thing is, we haven't done anything to experience that, except to wake up and to challenge this habitual hope and fear, this habitual momentum of desire, aversion, if you like, or just the agitation, just to wake up to that, to let it be in full consciousness and be willing to look at it and see what happens. And sometimes what we're looking at, what we're working with, it can be more powerful emotions, or it can be more strongly habitual negative thinking. And it's not so easy to snap out of. So our challenging of it, or the skillful means we have to bring to that, might need to be more powerful. Mm-hmm. So there's several skillful means for waking up, particularly if we're caught in these habitual movements of the mind. And one of those habitual movements too is just kind of sitting half awake, you know, maybe a little bit dull, or just listening to this chattering mind, but not really awake to it, just kind of chattering along with it. You know, it seems pretty benign, nothing too stressful, but there's not really a full wakefulness, you know. So we need to challenge when we sit to bring some thoughts to mind that might help us wake up. And one of the classic thoughts, perhaps to snap us out of this kind of dullness or complacency or a sense of half awakeness, is the thought of remembering our own death. Remembering that death is inevitable. One of the reflections in the chanting, the days and nights are relentlessly passing. How well am I spending my time? So this isn't an injunction to start berating yourself and say, oh, I'm so bad, I'm not spending my time very well at all, and get fearful. But it's meant to kind of wake you up in that moment. Oh yes, where am I putting my attention? What am I just, you know, going along with just because it's easy? Am I really waking up to this moment? Because the truth of death, even though we know it's going to happen, we have this kind of cotton wool deludedness, you know. We never know the time of death, but we somehow kind of think, well, it's not a conscious thought, but we just go along as if we're invulnerable, you know, until we really, something really wakes us up, like an illness that's, you know, could be really take us to our final passing, or a close loved one gets the terminal diagnosis or passes away. These kind of things can wake us up. But the Buddha said actually we need to challenge ourselves regularly with this notion that we don't know how long we've got. So how well are we spending our time? Are we using our waking hours to bring more awareness, to cultivate the path factors, to not get so, you know, caught up in the stuff that, you know, we really don't want to be with at our deathbed, you know? When I know for myself with, you know, watching the mind, the Buddha actually encouraged us to think of death every day, you know, to the point that you can even think on your in-breath, I might not be here for my next out-breath, or on your out-breath, I may not be here for my next in-breath, you know. That sounds pretty extreme, doesn't it? But he praised this kind of strong awareness of the vulnerability of life, you know, the vulnerability of this body, that death is inevitable. We don't know how long we've got. So what's important? This is what that reflection brings. What's important? Is the petty ramblings of my that my mind gets caught into sometimes, is that going to be important on my deathbed? You know, these are ways of just challenging Do I really want to hold that grudge against someone for something that happened a few years ago? If that's still annoying the heart from time to time, do I want to be with that on my deathbed? Do I want to die with that? You know, and usually the answer is no, we don't want to be holding this stuff on our deathbed. So this is a really helpful challenge when we find ourselves caught up in ways of thinking that are bringing dukkha, or ways of emoting that aren't helpful to us right now, or to others. You know, any kind of habitual momentum, or just the complacency, the chugging along but not really fully present, you know, using this thought to wake up and say, what's important? What would be good to shed before those few moments of last consciousness on my deathbed? You know, and then something wakes up in the mind and says, yeah, a whole lot would be useful to shed. A lot of this stuff that I get caught in is not, it's not that important. For everything, you know, everything we leave behind, we don't take anything with us, you know. So the only parami, if you like, the only thing we can take with us is, in some sense, is our spiritual what shall we call it, muscle, if you like, or our spiritual capacity, because that's what's going to support us on our deathbed. In fact, can we face into what's happening here and now, things that are out of our control, when the body, you know, is starting to give out? We have no control over the body. We have no control over the body in that sense, you know, in a daily basis. There's a certain measures we can take to look after the body, but we don't know what illness is going to emerge. We don't know, you know, how the body is going to work with it. But if we can face into whatever happens in this present moment, looking at the painful feelings, the difficulty, the difficulties that we might meet, whether physical, mental, or emotional, can we really meet those with full awareness and allow what is not important to really just be let go of? To recognize that everything is impermanent. That even when there's the lovely things of life, the beautiful things of life, it's not to not enjoy them, but to recognize these too are impermanent. These two are not things that I can take with me. And these kind of helps to undermine any sense of possessiveness or attachment to various things on the material level, but also even what we might experience in the level of the heart or the mind. As we watch different states, mind states come and go. So even the quality of peace that we can touch into from time to time, can we control it? Can we keep it when it's there? This morning I had really peaceful meditation, but the day before the mind was berserk. Completely out of control. And then something flipped. This morning was really peaceful. So you can start to think, got it together now, just keep this going. And then I come into the office and I start dealing with the mundane stuff of the office, and I sit here tonight and my mind's completely mundane, thinking about electricity bills and this and that. I don't know. It's like, where's that peace? And the mind, you can make a problem out of that. Or we can see the truth of impermanence. the truth of anatta. So, for example, tonight when our mind was complacent, grumbly, it's like, okay, it's not the way I want it, but it is the way it is. And then suddenly there's this quality of peace emerging again. So subtle, very subtle. But one recognizes that it's in the relationship to what's present. In fact, it doesn't really matter what the object is that's present. But if we can come out of that habitual push-pull, the wanting, not wanting, the judgment, this shouldn't be here, something else should be here. And also the habitual taking it to be a solid me. You know, one could get caught in, oh, I'm always this way. When am I going to get my practice together? You know, just waking up to that, seeing this is not a self. This is impermanent. This is unsatisfactory when grasped at. These mind states, these emotions, these different sensations, these thoughts, they come and go. That's the truth of the Dhamma that the Buddha wants us to see, because it brings this experience of being into full consciousness. So there is that which knows what's present, that which knows what's happening, and that quality or that capacity is always and only here and now. So we have to wake up to that, to recognize that. This ability to know is so connected with this quality of presence, this capacity of awareness itself. And it's that quality of mindfulness that keeps remembering this that can help us to wake up. I often talk about the using the paradigm of the Four Noble Truths as well, because waking up, we can wake up to this experience of dukkha if we learn to recognize dukkha when it's happening, because it's happening so often. It can be something that wakes us up. In fact, I think it was it Nisargadatta Maharaj who said something like, pleasure puts you to sleep, it's dukkha that wakes you up. And it's not as if we wish dukkha upon people or dukkha upon ourselves, but we've got enough of it going on. The problem is that we're mostly caught in that habitual relationship to it, which is trying to get rid of it rather than waking up to it. So this first noble truth, all the noble truths indeed, are about waking up. When we experience dukkha, to recognize this is dukkha. Just this experience, whether it's a feeling of boredom or complacency or just mild displeasure or extreme displeasure, whatever it is, it's not a problem. Doesn't that sound strange? Dukkha doesn't have to be a problem if we wake up to it. Because it can be an aid, a goad, in fact, for waking us up. So when we bring this into our, let's say, into our consciousness, into our present moment awareness, when dukkha becomes, we can turn dukkha into a noble truth. Once again, you have to practice with this to see what happens. What happens in the mind when you're witnessing dukkha, or you've woken up to the fact that this is unpleasant, whether it's mental, physical, emotional. As soon as you wake up to that fact, even momentarily, something has separated out. Something is no longer struggling with it. Just the waking up has already undermined a degree of that resistance, of that struggle. And part of that struggle, or perhaps a big part, if not all of that struggle, is the conceiving of myself in relation to this experience. Either I am this dukkha, or I have this dukkha, or dukkha is mine, my problem. But when we shine that light of full awareness, full presence onto this experience, something else happens. It shifts. It's no longer me and mine. There's this knowing of it, the witnessing of it, and it becomes an object of contemplation. And there is that which knows, that which is present. And it is only that that can know what happens as we engage in this kind of practice. How dukkha comes to cessation. Indeed, through this very undermining of the identification with it, undermining of the subtle push-pull, which is the craving, the tanha, the wanting, the not wanting. Just the undermining of that through seeing it clearly, seeing it as it is, already brings about the cessation of dukkha. Maybe not the complete cessation, as in it never arises again. But one can observe this in one's own experience. And thus, when you do that, something in your heart comprehends the path of practice, which is the fourth noble truth. The path of practice lying within this very way of knowing, this way of being present with what is. So this is our practice territory. We work with this mind, this heart. We work in the present moment as much as possible. In fact, our work is often, our skillful means that we learn is often to wake us up to come back to this present moment, to remember to be mindful, to remember to be present with this bodily experience. And from that point, we observe what unfolds in the mind. We see the Dharma playing out. We see dukkha when it arises. We come to understand the causes of dukkha, how it comes to be, and how it is allayed, how it is abandoned, how it is let go, how it is transformed in that very moment. There's no other way to practice. There's no other way to awaken. Of course, the depth of one's concentration can seriously help the clear seeing, seriously assist. So cultivating the samatha practices, cultivating mindfulness of breathing, mindfulness of body, present moment awareness as much as possible, this gathers strength, gathers steam, gathers momentum. And it works against the habitual stream, which is always mental stream, which is always looking into the future, even just the next moment, let alone tomorrow or next week or next month or next year. And then seeing clearly, looking into these truths of dukkha as it arises, impinges on the heart, and the unfolding of that experience. Seeing that, that's the clarity of the mind, the insight aspect of practice, that which understands arising and ceasing. And this sounds like such a simple, well, thankfully it is such a simple teaching, simple pointing, to notice this pattern of arising and ceasing on all levels. But if we just hold that intellectually, it's easy to dismiss, it's easy to think it's not much. But to bring it into our practice, to witness the momentary arising and ceasing of these different experiences, this is where it shows. This is where it takes the mind deep, more deep into calmness, into samadhi, and into the territory of insight. Many of the suttas that the Buddha, many of the teachings he gave that are recorded in the suttas, they give different, there's different stories and different ways that the disciples of the Buddha woke up to, the final awakening, final arahantship. And many of those suttas talk about using all these disciples becoming settled in mind, settled through concentration. And simply after being there for some time, the sutta says, and they, how I get this phrase right, when the mind became equanimous, then they saw with wisdom, that's all that happened, that they saw with wisdom the nature of the way things are and cut through, and as a consequence that cut through the asavas, destroyed greed, hatred and delusion. So in this kind of pattern of waking up, you see, people's minds can get quite settled to this place of equanimity, but with strong awareness, as long as there's strong awareness there, and just that clarity, if there's enough spiritual momentum, enough ripeness, there can be a seeing that cuts through the habitual momentum of the mind, cuts through the roots of greed, hatred and delusion, or what was called the asavas, the effluence, or what's another word for them? The kind of toxic waste, if you like, of the mind. That just that clarity cuts through this asava of becoming, the asava of ignorance, the asava of sensuality, that which is attached to the sense realm or getting pleasure from senses. So simply with clarity, they see with wisdom. And if the mind is ripe, the heart is ripe, this cutting through happens and they're suddenly fully awake. And in other teachings you get the Buddha giving disciples direct teachings of how to contemplate different things, to contemplate the elements this way, or contemplate your sense impressions, your sense experience in this way, or contemplate the khandhas in this way. And as they did that, as they proceeded in their practice to contemplate in this way that the Buddha taught them to, then they saw with wisdom. So you can see for these people there was a bit more of active investigation, active contemplation of the five khandhas, the six sense bases, the four elements. Yeah? So you can see in these teachings that there are different tendencies for people, some who may settle into concentration more easily, and when the wisdom factor is also ripe, the cutting through happens. For others, maybe they work the insight, they really work the contemplative mind until the penny drops, but still there is enough concentration together with that wisdom for the cutting through to happen, the seeing clearly with wisdom the way things are. You know, so for each of us, you know, it's awakening is not going to happen in the same way as perhaps any other person in terms of our area of contemplation, you know, but it could be any particular thing that interests us, whatever's taking our interest in terms of Dharma inquiry, that we can pick up as a template, a paradigm for inquiry. If there's real interest there, the mind will go deep with it. You know? So I think you all listened to Venerable Anālio's instructions, the meditative instructions going through the four satipatthana, you know. So some of those practices are there. If you find the contemplation on thinking about this body is going to die, if you find that helpful, if you find it interesting in terms of what it does to your mind, how it brings you more present, then use that. Use it for a while. Pick up these skillful means. If something else interests you, it may be an investigation around the senses, just the quality of hearing, the sound of silence, or hearing the sounds of nature, or experiencing the different sensations that arise when sounds, different sounds come and go, the different tone of different people's voices. What does that trigger in one's mind stream, in one's consciousness? If this is an interesting contemplation, pick it up. If there's something that keeps habitually returning in your practice, instead of trying to get rid of it or wish you were over it, really pick it up. What is it? What is it that's returning? What is it that needs to be seen? Can I inquire into this? Is it a sensation on a physical level? Is it an emotion? Is it a memory? Is it a hope? Is it a fear? Get interested in it in terms of Dhamma. Inquire into it. If your interest is there, the energy will follow, the mindfulness will follow, the investigation can go deeper. And all of these qualities can bring about this quality of samadhi, can help stoke the fires of concentration or calm, even as one's investigating, looking into. So learning to use what presents itself in any given moment as that which can be awoken to, that which can be inquired into, that which can be your teacher. Even if it's just the boredom or the complacency that happens in sitting, or that the chattering, mundane mind, like was going on in my mind tonight. It's like learning to wake up to that and just see it for what it is. Yes, chattering. A judgment about mundane. Ah, okay, when that's there, I see there's a subtle aversion to it. Oh, I see I don't really want it. Ah, okay, so there's aversion in the mind. How is that? As soon as you start to look into it, It releases, it relaxes, and there's a change in the mind. And now I'm really interested. It's changed. There's more presence. The aversion's not gone, not here. I can hear the silence. There's the peace. So if we don't start to investigate, you know, we just can be caught in that narrow stream of habit. So you can see how important it is just to keep waking up, to so use this experience of dukkha in that mundane unsatisfactoriness, kind of, it's just a bit like this. Use it to wake up. It's thoroughly possible to wake up to. Because, you know, much of our life can be spent in that space, those kind of spaces. So I just offer these few thoughts for us all tonight and hope that that will help us in our cultivation.